This is a special edition of U.S. Modernist Radio featuring Mike McCarthy and Marcia Myers and project architect Todd Williams. I'm Tom Guile, and with George Smart, we explored the iconic Douglas House in Harbor Springs, Michigan, designed by Richard Meyer.
Hi, Marcia. We looked up the history of the house, and it looks like this house, the Douglases, were associated with U-Haul or General Hitch of Canada at the time. How did they go about commissioning this house?
Well, they originally saw the Smith House on a magazine and contacted Richard Meyer's office to build them a Smith House in Michigan. They were from Michigan. Douglas's ran the Blue Star Truck Company in Grand Rapids. And so they were familiar with Michigan and up north, and they wanted the Smith House built up north. And when they bought their first property there, it was on a flat piece of land similar to the Smith House, Connecticut house. And the homeowner said, well, we don't allow white houses in here. And so both Richard Meyer and the Douglases, thank goodness, said, well, then we don't want to be here. And they searched for a property and went on up a little bit north of Harbor Springs and found this spectacular wooded steep cliff and said, what about this? And I think Todd Williams had come out at the time and he thought that would be good and sent back some thoughts to Richard. And Richard said, I don't have any idea how people can build on this, but we will figure it out. And that started the journey to build this spectacular house on the steep cliff on Lake Michigan, on the beach, up in Harbor Spring.
It was a bit of luck, if I might add, that Todd's family had a house on Torch Lake, which is a nearby lake, an inland lake, a smaller lake, but still he knew the area and was really helpful in finding the location. And he really wanted to do the design for this house. So it was a bit of magic between Todd and Richard to take the thing on. And then Todd actually lived there for about a year while the house was being built. Has great stories of he and his kids when they were little, all playing at the house while it was being built.
That must have been just spectacular experience for a young architect building this house that was almost immediately iconic.
Yeah, it turned out that way. They obviously couldn't build it on a flat plot, and figuring out how to put it on the hill ended up being a fabulous career move for both Richard and for Todd. They had to put this thing on pilings. A lot of people don't know it's actually has no regular foundation. It's built on pilings, and then they built this wooden house up on top of that. And because it was down the slope from the road, they had to build the bridge from the road going 40 feet over to the roof and thus turn upside down the Smith House, doing those kinds of creative things to make this house on that hillside made the house spectacular and was a big lift for Richard Meyer's career and the famousness of the house, actually.
And of course, the house is spectacular to see if you're there, but most of the photographs are from the water of Lake Michigan, looking up at the house.
Right. From the road, you don't even recognize that it's there. All you see is this white flash. Basically, what you're seeing is the roof. I remember when Mike and I first went up there, we were driving down the road looking at other houses. This was 10 years before we bought this thing. And I pointed out the window. I saw this flash of white, and it looked contemporary, and it looked like the ocean. We call Lake Michigan an ocean. Out there was a spectacular sight. And I said, I'll take that. And he goes, yeah, right. I'm sure we could afford that. So 10 years later, it had reached the, deterioration level that the price came down. And we actually said, well, let's go for it. But at the time, we didn't know who Richard Meyer was. And we weren't buying it because it was a Richard Meyer house. We just thought it was a
gorgeous house,
a cool house on a beach on Lake Michigan in a spectacular setting. Mike, being the engineer, looked at it and said, bridge is sagging. We don't know if the house is going to stay on the cliff. swing stairs is unsafe. It's moving. It's rotted. There's carpenter ants around.
Now, if you were trying to tell friends how to find the house, did they have trouble because it was so hard to see from the road?
Yeah, people drive by it. A lot of people have lived up there their whole lives, don't know where it is. And eventually when you tell them, they go, oh, yeah. But many know it from their boating, you know, when they're out on the lake. And they,
because it's so easy to see from the lake.
They view the house from that side. It's actually like a visual sign as people come around the point from upper Michigan, Mackinac Island kind of area. They come around, right. And when they see our house, they go, oh, we're almost to Harbor Springs. And they use it like a beacon. So all the yachting people and the boating
people. Yes, see, it's a navigation aid.
People on the road don't know it so much.
Mike and Marcia, you all are the fourth owners of the house. The second owners in 1981 of this beautiful modernist house added carpeting, foil wallpaper, heavy drapes, and early American furniture. What were they thinking?
They were thinking they were up north Michigan people. And the way I hear the story, the woman wanted it to be an up north cottage. And so she put in the green shag carpeting and some foil wallpaper down the circular stairwell in the house and moved out some of the furniture, put a great big sundial up on the beautiful white wall. And
oh, Lord.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't be the first time a modernist house has been disguised with wallpaper and carpet.
Yeah.
The good thing was she didn't tear out any walls.
Good,
good.
She turned one of the bedrooms into a closet, though, I understood.
Whoa, she must have had a lot of clothes.
Then the third owner in 1985, Paul and Penny Beitler, they recognized this mess and did the first restoration. What did they do?
Yeah, Paul and Penny Beitler. Paul was a commercial real estate developer and manager. Penny, his wife, was a psychiatrist, family psychiatrist, just wonderful people. But Paul, JP, everybody calls him JP, knew the importance of the house. And he went in and had the house painted white, cleaned up the inside a bit, attracted back the Corbusier furniture, either bought new or in some cases found where it had gone and bought it back, and basically restored the house to what it was originally. And then as an ex-military helicopter pilot and a CEO of a company, he had a helicopter in Chicago where they lived. And so they used to fly over on weekends for family weekends, that sort of thing, and actually did some charity work where they auctioned off a dinner at the famous house. And JP would fly people over in his helicopter and land nearby and have quite a nice soiree.
Where do you land? Yeah, if the house is on a cliff, do you land on the roof? Where do you land?
There's a little airport in Harbor Springs, so they go in there and then out to the house.
How convenient.
Although he did build a tennis court for his daughter, so he maybe landed it on that. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, he's told me that he landed on the beach one or two times, but he got quite a bit of complaints, and landing on sand is not the best thing for helicopters of the kind that he flew. So
I would think so.
Yeah, we view the Beitlers as having saved the house. They knew and contacted Richard Meyer and put it back the way it was intended to be.
Yeah, they were the first ones that went, we followed their model, but they were the first ones who went back to Richard and got a set of the plans, the original design plans, and navigated off of that for their restoration. That was also the set of plans that, as is often the case with famous houses, were not as built. They were as designed. And the house was originally designed to be on a flat lot. So there's quite a bit about the house that Todd Williams needed to change when he actually lived on site and built the place. But kind of a bit of magic, all of that.
Now, when you buy a house like this, I know you all have realized that you don't own the house. The house kind of owns you.
We thought we were buying a house to own it and be our beautiful summer home on the lake, but the home searched us out and found us. Right after we moved in, Yukio Futagama from Global Architecture in Japan.
Sure.
He'd done Global Architecture publication on the house in 1978. So he knew the house, but he was coming back in 2007 to all of the houses he considered masterpieces and put a publication out in 2015 called Residential Masterpieces. And we were going, wow, that's significant. And by then, AIA people had chosen this house as 130 on the top 150 favorite houses in the country, and only 10 of them were houses. And we're going, that seems important. Finally, we got a call from Dominic Bradbury, and I understand you've interviewed him.
Yes.
That he wanted to do a book called Iconic Houses of the Last Century and named our house as one of the top architect-designed, most significant houses, one of 100 in the whole world. And only 30 of those were in America. So all of a sudden, this was not just a house that we thought was really cool and stunning and well-designed and amazing, that now our restoration took on a new meaning. I mean, we're stewards of this to put it back to better than it started.
And you are working to build an endowment that will allow the public to visit the house more into the future. How is that going?
In fact, it just turned 50 years old this year, and we've been wanting to leave the house for another 50 years after Mike and I pass. And so the idea of this operating foundation, so that visitors can continue to come, architects and students and designers who come from all over the world, even now, will have a place to come and study. And because the people that study it in their books cannot believe it when they walk into the space and experience what living in a, really, it's a piece of art.
A sculpture.
Yes, a sculpture. We call it a sculpture also. But anyway, Mike can fill you in on a little bit of thinking we've done around the foundation. But yes, we do hope that it lasts another 50 years. And the visitors say, how can a wooden house on the beach in Lake Michigan with the ice and snow on a steep slope even last 50 years, let alone another 50? But that's the challenge we've taken on.
It's hard to beat Marcia's coverage from the many tours that she has done there. She's kind of been a docent. The idea going forward is, since the house was really designed to be a residence, we're structuring the operating foundation so that it'll have a resident docent. And we've picked a couple of generations of people that are already involved, already do some tours when we're out of town, that sort of thing. They're people that are really know about the house, really committed to the house. One of them, Garen Gopigian, actually grew up across from the house, played with the Douglas kids when he was little and they were little, tells all the stories about what kind of hot dogs or popcorn they had while sitting on beanbags on this floor or that floor, that sort of thing. But very committed to the house, and he actually wrote for us the application for the National Register. And so he's knee-deep in it, and he and some others will be the people that will live in it after we're gone. It'll still be a residence, but it'll be available for people that, as Marcia said, want to come and study or come and visit. And it's true. People come and see the place no matter how much they think they know about it. Joseph Giovannini recently visited, and he's an architect.
Oh, sure. He's been on our show. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful fellow. Very solid intellectual, good architect. But he just raved about the place when he saw it for the first time. It happened he was having a meal with a neighbor that also knows the house well. And
his business partner was one of the
Saarinen
children or grandchildren.
So anyway, Joseph was having dinner with him, and the subject came up that, you know, right down the street, there's one of the Meyer houses, and Joseph didn't know that. And so they just popped over and had a tour of the place, and Joseph's one of our fans.
He just finished an article that was put on Architectural Record in, when was that? January, I guess.
It was January.
Yeah, recognizing the 50 years of the house and a lot of the restoration. He was very interested in the restoration that we'd been doing for 15 years.
Yeah, but to the point that you raised, that the experience of being in the house is so much different than what you see when you look at drawings, even as an architect. He was just astounded by, he called it the Cartesian discipline that was so evident in Meyer at such a young age, whatever that means.
Well, he's very much the scholar, so calling it Cartesian would be something I would expect to hear coming out of his mouth. Well, this has been a really wonderful conversation. The website for the house is douglashouse.org, O-R-G. Mike and Marcia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Todd, before we get started talking about the Douglas House, let's talk about another house, which has unfortunately gone away. One of your first ones, the Tarlow House in Sagaponack.
Yeah.
How did that house get started?
I was introduced to Sagaponack by a friend who was a client and a little older than I, and I did his apartment and did his office. And then he had a house out on the water there. And along the way, I met a beautiful young woman and started dating her. And her name was Devin Fredericks. That's still her name. And her mother was a realtor, and they thought I had talent. And she said, look, I've got a distant relative from England who wants to do a spec house. And would you like to be the architect? And so it was a spec house for the Tarlows. And they were from England, and he imagined this inexpensive piece of potato field. We could make a house at low cost that would suit him and his family as they would come over. Eventually, Devin dropped me. I was not the most faithful boyfriend. She found somebody much better. And that house was my first modernist house. And at the same time, because my other friend had shown me that I could move barns around, I did two other projects at that time that were speculative for myself. Also because Devin's mother, Tina Fredericks, found the property and said, you know, this is good land. It's low cost. You should do something here. So I was encouraged by two wonderful women who were not in my life anymore. So, but it was exciting because the only stipulation for the Tarlow House, and I didn't meet him until the house was done, but it was absolutely clear I had a total of $80,000 that I could spend. That included all architecture and landscape and the house itself. I could spend it as I wished, but it needed to have a full basement, needed to have a kitchen, a dining room actually separate, a living room, and three bedrooms and baths. So it was a tiny little house. And I did it within the budget. Unfortunately, I used a contractor who was 29 years old and really hadn't built before. And then you put that guy together with me. I was a little bit older. And we made a bunch of not very sturdy decisions in terms of construction. I chose a window that was out of Sweet's catalogs and just put the windows together. And by the time I actually got the windows on the house, the company had gone bankrupt. So those Woodco windows were not the best. So again, early house, I felt great about it. It had an idea of the abstraction of the work that I'd done with Richard Meyer and was thinking about it at that time, made of natural wood. Unfortunately, it was pretty flimsy, but the cost of land and everything around meant that the bulldozer was ready to take it over. And you could probably just blow on the wall and it would fall over.
The pictures of it are really stunning. I mean, just gorgeous.
Well, and the woman who bought it a few years after the Tarlow sold it lived there. I think she was involved in the theater. She adored it, but I think it was getting old and the house was, it took a lot to repair. And then she gave in and I remember she apologized to me that she would have to sell it.
Well, let's go back to the Douglas House. You were working for Richard Meyer, and I believe the story was that the fellow who he was somehow connected with, U-Haul of Canada, was the client?
It was Blue Arrow Douglas. That was the name of his trucking firm. His name was Jim Douglas, and his wife,
Jean.
Jean, of course, and they had three kids. And Richard got the commission when he went out to Detroit to receive an AIA award for, I think, the Smith House. He came back and said, hey, guess what? I sold the plans of the Smith House to these people in Michigan. And I said, what? You sold the plans of the Smith House? Now, Richard may have a different story, but maybe he's not talking anymore. But this would be my story.
Sure.
He actually, I think, sold them for $10,000 and was planning. And I said, Richard, two problems there. Number one, you've got to get permission from the Smiths, I think. Little did I know, I didn't really know I was. And also I said, well, I come from Michigan and I sort of know the area they want to build. In fact, I know it very well because my grandparents live up there and I spent every year of my life there, still have. So he let me become the project architect. I'm not sure I had the wits or the capability to be the project architect. Douglas had bought a piece of property in Larbor Croach. It's a development community down in near Harbor Springs. It's still there. And they had building restrictions. And I went out to meet the Douglases, who were lovely people. And Jim said, well, Richard wants this to be a White House, but they don't allow White Houses, so maybe it'll be gray. So we actually began to put the house and modify it a little bit on this flat piece of land in Larbor Croach on the water. But the further one went through that, the more the community didn't like Richard's design. And Jim got mad because he got mad at being stopped, as Richard got mad at being stopped. And I think at that time I said, you should check out this area that's north. There's some beautiful, beautiful land up north of Harbor Springs. And if you go look up there, that's my favorite part in all of Michigan. And they did, and everyone probably knew about it. Certainly Richard didn't, but this extraordinary site up there, the Douglases bought it, had an existing low house, not very well built on the inland side of the house, and then this beautiful piece of property. I think it was about 300 feet long. We redesigned the house on the sloping site, and that gave us the chance to really rethink the house as much as Richard would allow, and I could get him to both buy into. So my thinking was that it was using the same ingredients as the Douglas house, but choosing to make it a unique piece on its own piece of property. Richard was very busy at the time, and so I had a lot of room to move, and I had a nice relationship with Jim and Jean.
And didn't you live there for some period of time?
I did, and as it was to be built, I was thinking about it. I had a couple of times thought, gee whiz, my life is changing. I was married and had two children, and I wanted to maybe go out on my own. So I started to begin to get people ask me to do work. And so I decided that it would be really great for marriage and for my experience to go out there while it was being built, which I did, and lived just half a mile south of the house on the water in a cabin. It was a beautiful, glorious summer, long, long summer, that I watched it go into the ground.
Isn't that kind of the architect's ideal fantasy of working on this spectacular project while living nearby in this beautiful place?
Oh my God, it was, and of course, it was actually just a vacation, as far as I could tell. It was the greatest vacation almost ever. It would have healed the marriage if it had gone on forever, I suppose. But we, the kids and I were, and my wife, I would go back and forth to New York to report to Richard and to make, we had another guy in the studio working on it, actually two people working on it who were more competent than I. One was much younger and was very, very rigorous, a guy named John Colomarino. He's still around, I'm sure. And a wonderful guy from actually Vietnam, Sherman Kung, who had his own firm, and another wonderful person. So I had support. Richard was looking the other way, and I don't think he came out to visit until the building was done.
And when it was done, it was a huge success. I mean, it was published everywhere.
I know. And because it already had the bones of the Smith House, which were great, and using that motif, we flipped the plan and then flipped it back and forth and flipped it and eventually began to make it much more a kind of statement, maybe too much of a statement. So we created a bridge across to the house. We drove it into the pine forest by dropping piles. The guy who actually set the piles had come off making the Mackinac Bridge, and he was a kind of a wild guy, maybe 45 years old, and had his own rig. And I didn't know. I thought we were going to do step foundations on it. So I'd call back to Ed Messina from the engineering office, say, Ed, can we do this? We've designed it as regular step foundations. He said, oh, no, you can't do that. He determined that we needed to drive pilings in. So they're basically telephone poles that were like the pine trees themselves that became that. And then we skirted the house with siding, so it felt very, very sculptural, and entered from the top and went down. All of this made very little financial and living sense, but it was incredibly beautiful because you were looking due west out of Lake Michigan, floating above this pine forest. And, you know, Jim Douglas would come to see the house, and he began to wear reflective sunglasses. It was just unbelievably bright when it was bright. They lived in Grand Rapids and were thinking about retiring and coming up there. And I think they did briefly, but then Jim, within, I think, 3 years, they sold and moved to San Francisco.
Yeah, they sold in 1981 to a guy who added carpeting, foil wallpapers, heavy drapes, and early American furniture. Woo!
I never saw that, but it's funny, it's 81, so it was quite a bit later. Huh. Well, they moved earlier than that, no question, but 81, wow. So we finished the house, I don't know, I'm going to guess in 73 or 4, 73.
Yeah.
I had left the office about 6 months earlier. I didn't really see the very end of the construction. And I'd be very curious as to how long Jim and Jean lived there and stayed there before they moved to San Francisco. But I think they visited from time to time. I don't know the second owner. Then was there a third owner too, perhaps?
Oh, yes. There was a third owner. That owner was Paul and Penny Beitler,
uh-huh.
who did a restoration in the 80s.
I did see that. I never saw it with the 81, the horrible, yikes. Okay.
Now, when you left Richard Meyer's firm in 73, what did you do between then and the time you started your own practice?
Well, I started my own practice the moment I left there. I told Richard I had a house from a friend, high school friend had asked me to do it in Colorado. And I said, you know, I'd really like to work on it. I met this guy and he came to me and I'd like to have it in your office. And he said, well, if it's in my office, it's my house. And I said, uh-oh. Said, I asked Richard, well, will you make me your partner? He said, no.
Wow.
So I said goodbye. I took the house, and then I had been separated from my wife, and I worked on the house and took it into working drawings. And then the owner, he had divorced his wife, or the wife divorced him, and the house never got built. So suddenly I was out of work. But Richard also sent me, kindly enough, two other projects that were small. So I survived for a little bit. And then I finally realized I wasn't really going to survive. I've got a partner who is a friend. That's another mistake you can make. Mostly a friend rather than a real partner.
Yeah.
And then that went for a while. It was called Potters Williams Architects, and then went on my own. And eventually Billy came to work for me. I was always, as working on the house, thinking of both Richard and the site, mm-hmm. and what's Richard's work should be and the site. So I could converse with him pretty comfortably about the house. He was so busy and had so much going on that it's his house 100%. But in a way, I was trying to be inside his head and in my own. I don't know how one does that, but that's what people do from time to time.
Well, let's fast forward now. So you are working on the presidential library for President Obama. A number of years you've been working on that. I assume that this started, like many of these do, with some sort of competition you had to enter?
Well, the first competition, this came by submitting credentials, and 140 people or so submitted credentials when there was a calling for the Obama Presidential Library. Ultimately, that was culled down to about 30 people, and from the 30, by another series of requests and information about the firm, culled down to 7, and then we competed for it. So it was a long and arduous way to get a job, but it was an amazing and is an amazing job, and like it's a job of a lifetime.
Now, when you win it, Todd, does Barack Obama call you up and say, hey, you're the one?
He actually did.
Really?
He actually did that. It was the best. He actually did that. And he didn't quite say you won. He said, I'd like you to come in and meet me. Each of the 7 competitors did meet Barack and Michelle Obama at the White House in the Oval Office because they wanted to get to know the architect. So Billy and I went down to the Oval Office and met with 2 people from the foundation and President and Michelle Obama and spent an hour with them. Every one of the competitors did that. So they got a feel for us and we got a feel for them. But then we had to compete and the competition was arduous and took a long time. I have to say we didn't get paid for it, but we did it willingly and produced a huge amount of work. And when we knew that we were down close to getting it, he called and said, would you come on down to Washington, D.C.? I'd like to talk to you about the project. I think it was the day before his daughter's birthday or something like that. And we went into a very heavily guarded anonymous building and went down into the basement, and he walked us through all of the competition entries, telling us the virtues of every other project. Of course, we were like, oh my God, I cannot believe that they produce such beautiful work and we got this project. But in the end, he did say, yes, this is your project, but I want you to do a couple of things.
I have read that Obama wanted to be an architect at one point in his life. Was that true?
I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. He's wanted to be a lot of things and could be a lot of things. But one of the things that's clear he has an interest in is form and art and architecture. And the guy can read plans. The guy is deeply invested in trying to understand. Not as much as I would like him to, I should say. He doesn't really care about, as much in my opinion, how things work, how they're put together. But he does care a lot about how they look. And so he was constantly involved in that and wanted us to show him and explain to him. There was one period where he was complaining about he didn't understand how form developed. And so he wanted to see other alternatives. And I said, well, I'm sorry, the building's virtually described already. We know the size. We know where things are. What do you mean? You want me to show how you make shapes and fate? And he said, yeah. So we went back to the studio and ultimately constructed 25 different models of the possibilities given the internal organizations of the building. So, in fact, a building doesn't always have to look exactly like it works.
Oh, sure. Yes, that's definitely true.
It's a little bit like a human body. You can have all the organs in the same place and be quite different on the outside. I think that's what he felt. And I think actually that was a really interesting exploration, which I hope no other clients ask architects to do.
Now, that was approximately 2016, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
What's the status of this project now in 2025?
Well, I'll be out there in a week. Billy will be too. The form is almost entirely there. The primary element is a tower. This is the shaped tower that he ultimately asked us to construct. We knew where the pieces and parts were, but it's there. It's being clad in stone. And then one of the interesting features is the Selma speech as a kind of decorative screen on the top of the building. And that will be going in this summer. Parts of the buildings are being finished as we speak. Parts of them will lag. We have someone going out tomorrow to think about the site because, you know, it's a 19-acre site, at least, if not larger, all of which is landscaped, working with Michael van Valkenburg. But most of the building is actually below the landscaping, including a 460-car garage and all of the services done below grade. And so we've created a park on top of all this stuff.
So 460 cars. Now, is that intended? Is the staff going to be that big in that place?
No.
Or is that allowing for visitors?
No, it's absolutely. In fact, I complained about it. You can complain to your clients, but they don't always listen to you. You can say, look, I understand what you're saying. I don't want to be president who's endorsing private cars, but we also want people to come there. And it's Chicago and it gets cold and people are thinking about suburban families and so on and so forth. So that's the way it is. And that came to us both from his mouth and from the people for whom we work, the Obama Presidential Foundation.
Okay.
So our idea was to get rid of all service. And our idea was actually to have somebody else build a parking garage somewhere else if necessary, or to use, you know, automatic cars as we thought would be existing at that time. But no, it'll be a good garage. And for sure, that was the requirement. But at least we said, well, I don't want to see them. We want them below the landscaping. And so that was an accepted compromise. Architecture is all about communication, compromise, positive compromise, I hope, and solving problems, just like the Douglas House. You've got a problem. Well, Jim, you can't use the same plans. You've got a different site.
Yeah, sure. When that project is all finished in Chicago with this presidential library, when is it going to be the big party? I know that's a moving target, but when do you think you're going to open and have all the network TV stations there and CNN and everybody's going to show up?
I've been told it's next spring.
Okay.
And I will believe it when I see it. There's a lot of work to be done. I think it actually could open, and they want it to open, and I believe it very well might open next spring, right about this time. The building and the site will continue to evolve and grow over the years ahead and the centuries ahead. it'll be there a long time because there's a lot going on and a lot that should make it a really, really permanent and important structure for Chicago and for the world.
Well, I can't wait to see you, Todd. Thank you so much for talking with me and sharing the story of these projects, old and new.
It's a long journey, but a super exciting one. I thank you for indulging me and the audience as well.